Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Denise Clancy, and I represent Appellant Mr. Kaczynski in this matter. We have, and I would like to reserve with court permission, 5 minutes for response slash rebuttal. We have two matters that we are appealing. First is, did the trial court err in dismissing Mr. Kaczynski's Larimer County claims as compulsory counterclaims to the prior Weld County action? The second issue is, did the trial court err in having dismissed those claims under Rule 13A, applying statutes 1317-201 and 1316-1132 to apply fees to that order, even though those claims only apply to actions dismissed under Rule 12B. I'll take up the first issue, which is the compulsory counterclaim. The law in this state as a compulsory counterclaim follows the same transaction or occurrence under Rule 13A. In visual factor, the Supreme Court said that there must be the same factual matrix. And the policy behind that is you want to avoid inconsistent judgments on the same issue, and that was well set forth in the Dinosaur Park case. Analyzing, and the briefs go into this extensively, but a thorough analysis of Court of Appeals and Supreme Court cases shows that there are basically four instances in which claims have been found to be compulsory. One, the same contract is at issue. Two, one claim would act as a set-off to another claim. Three, one claim would have the effect of entirely canceling out the other claim. Or four, they literally involve the same facts and circumstances. And so the same evidence would be presented at trial.
Ms. Clancy, although the case law that you've discussed falls fairly evenly so far into those four patterns, is that any kind of an exclusive list, or applying the law, would it be possible to create some other sort of legal scenario in which the mandatory counterclaim would fall into place?
They didn't say, the cases have not held that this is, although those are the only situations in which the courts of appeals to date have found, and the Supreme Court have found, compulsory counterclaims, they haven't said per se this is exclusive. But by definition, when you apply the factors set forth by the Supreme Court, which is that it has to arise from the same transaction or occurrence, the same factual matrix, or as the Bethune case says, res judicata would compel one claim to be decided if the other claim is, really there are not situations outside of those four that would arise that would fit into the parameters established by the Colorado Supreme Court.
So would your position be that arising out of the same employment context would be too broad?
Absolutely, and here's why. The overarching subject material is not enough. It can't, in other words, the trial court's justification for Rule 13A is, here, they knew each other because they were employee or employer. And the courts are clear that it's not enough that you knew each other because of one situation. So for example, in Bethune, they knew each other because every issue involved the same three parcels of land. The first suit involved pseudo or fraudulent misappropriation of fees with respect to that land, and the second suit involved failure to pay on a promissory note with respect to that same land. But the court held that different contracts were at issue, and even though the same parties were at issue and the same three parcels of land were at issue, that's not enough to constitute the same factual matrix. Here we have entirely different facts. Yes, did they know each other because once for 3 months they were an employee and employer? Absolutely. But the problem is we have two entirely different claims. The first claim is the Weld County claim arose a year after Mr. Kaczynski was employed by K2D. A year after his employment, K2D, when it was involved in another lawsuit with Capital Value, called him as a third-party witness, subpoenaed him as a third-party witness. And as part of that process, they said that he had misappropriated documents and in breach of a confidentiality agreement that he had signed while employed at K2D. That claim for misappropriation of documents, breach of confidentiality agreement, and injunction for return of the documents is entirely different from the matters at issue in Mr. Kaczynski's claim.
But at the time that claim arose, which you say was about a year later, whatever claim Mr. Kaczynski had against the company relating to the employment arrangement had also borne fruit, so to speak. It could have been filed then, right?
Yes, the claim could have been filed then.
And then the other question is, and maybe this is another criteria, is there anything that prevented Mr. Kaczynski from filing those claims in the Weld County case as counterclaims?
I do not see anything that would have prevented him from filing as permissive counterclaims, but they were not compulsory in that they didn't involve the same contracts.
But he could have filed them as permissive counterclaims. Surely. Let me put it this way, the facts were known to him at that time.
The facts were known, but the criteria, nowhere is the criteria stated that the time at which your claim arises or bears fruit is whether is the determination as to whether it's a compulsory counterclaim as to another, or even that it's permissive is compulsory, because this is a very draconian remedy.
But efficiency is a consideration, isn't it? Or saving court resources, I guess is how they express it.
No, well, efficiency is a consideration only insofar as they say, and they're very careful to say this, efficiency is a consideration only insofar as you don't want one thing that you determined in the first action to be entirely wiped out by the second action. So
But you don't want the same witnesses called in Weld County and then 6 months later called in Larimer County. You don't want the same documents entered in Weld County 6 months later in Larimer County. I mean, that's not how the case is phrased, but I think that's the point of what they're trying to say.
Actually, respectfully, I disagree on it. The point is, that is actually almost never the criteria that we want to do, make sure that we have don't have to avoid calling the same witnesses.
So saving resources is not a criteria in determining.
The same judicial resources is a criteria insofar as if we have literally the exact set of facts and circumstances, the same factual matrix. So, for example, in the Skyholder case, a union protested work being done by non-union members, and the company said, well, look, if by virtue of your protesting, you've caused us a lot of delayed work, and we've had to hire security forces. That was one was as a direct result as the other. Mm-hmm. Literally in that situation, because you have literally the same factual circumstances, the same act propelled the same damages, in that instance, the court is right. In that rare instances where you have the same damages arising out of the same propelling motion, yes, that would be a compulsory counterclaim. But here, in contrast, there's no factual overlap in terms of we've got determination of at the time, was he fraudulently induced into employment? Was there a breach of his stock options? Was there a breach of his health insurance? That's what we're looking at in the Larimer County case.
And that those events all occurred on or before the time he was terminated.
Correct. And the events giving rise to the Weld County case, with the exception of the signature of the confidentiality agreement, all occurred after the time that he was terminated. And at no point has K2D argued that anything that his firing had anything to do with his misappropriation of documents. They've never said that it had anything to do with it whatsoever.
So, counsel, going back to the compulsory counterclaims, it looks like there's sort of a broad catch-all language, at least according to the division in the McCabe case, where they say whether the claims involve all or many of the same factual and legal issues or offshoots of the same basic controversy between the parties. How have the courts been dealing with the language or offshoots? What does that mean in this context?
Well, going to offshoots, it has to be, so for example, that would be Skylander as an example of an offshoot, because the union alleges civil rights violation. Now, was the counterclaim anything to do with the civil rights violation or anything to do with federal law? No, but it was an offshoot of the union's actions because they had higher security forces and they suffered damages because of that. Let me give you an example of how careful the courts are delineating. In the In re Crodia case, which involved an issue over a partnership interest, one man was a guardian for a woman's estate. And in that case, he said, look, you owe me, the woman said, you illegally took my partnership interest. And he said, no, I didn't, because that was actually payment for service rendered. The court said clearly that's a compulsory counterclaim. But his other issue with respect to also Mrs. Estate, you took my rugs, that has nothing to do, even though that is still a claim as between the two parties. It arose as between his guardianship relationship with her. The In re Curiae court was careful to delineate and separate out the rug claim from the other claim, which was the partnership agreement. So the courts are careful that it has to be within those four criteria that I set forth before. Literally, one has to almost cancel the other out in order to constitute such a high bar that it is a compulsory counterclaim.
And you have less than 5 minutes.
Thank you. I'll just take 30 seconds and cover the statutory issue, which is the 1317-201 and 1316-1132 are plain language. They apply to 12B. Counsel for KGD is asking this court to set new law. There's literally not one Colorado case which holds that a 13A is properly dismissed under 12B. There's literally not one Colorado case in which attorney's fees were awarded under these statutes for a claim that was dismissed under 13B. The trial court, without citing authority, said that it should be dismissing under these statutes under 12B because it was, quote, the only mechanism. But no case has ever held that, and this would be creating new law. It would be adding language to the statute impermissibly, and most importantly, it's making Rule 13A superfluous, because if, as counsel argues, Rule 12b-5 is the way to do it, it is the way to say it's a failure to state a claim on which relief can't be granted, then there would be no need for 13A to even exist. But 13A is its own statute, its own mechanism, and courts prior to this case have always used 13A as its own mechanism to resolve the dispute, and there's no application of the 12b-5 mandatory fee statutes here. I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Dan Williams. I represent the appellees, Mr. LaFleur, Mr. Babcock, and company K2D. May it please the court. A lot of the discussion on the merits issue, if you will, about whether the dismissal was proper turns on what the purpose of Rule 13's bar is. And actually what the case law says about what the purpose is what Judge Richman had to say, which is it is designed to prevent a multiplicity of proceedings. The state shouldn't have to suffer through two parties having lawsuits in multiple counties. And a related principle, there's efficiency, which is certainly a very high and important value that underlies the rules, but there's also a principle about stopping forum shopping, which frankly is what happened here. What happened here was there was a case in Weld County. Mr. Kaczynski did file an answer in Weld County. His answer reserved the right to bring counterclaims. He got an adverse result in Weld County and wanted to pick a different court to litigate in, and chose Larimer County. And
I thought he was defaulted in Weld County.
He was defaulted after he was defaulted, he actually filed an answer with the court. It's part of his effort to try to cure the default.
A proposed answer.
I'm sorry?
A proposed answer.
It's listed on the docket as an answer. The judge there referred to it as an answer. This court has now reversed the default and the case has been remanded. Presumably the Weld County Court will now just sort out whether it needs to be refiled or if it's already there. But in any event, he considered bringing his counterclaims in Weld County, opted not to, and went to Larimer County to bring them. And that is exactly what Rule 13 is designed to prevent. It's designed to prevent splitting claims.
Mr. Williams, I understand obviously the parties are involved in the same employment situation or relationship, but could you articulate what facts are the same facts that would be at issue in both proceedings?
Yes, I can. Let's start with the employment relationship. At its heart in Larimer, the claim is I was fraudulently induced into coming to work for you. I didn't want to enter into this employment relationship. The employment relationship involved a series of contracts, one of which was a confidentiality agreement, one of which was an agreement to work and be paid for the labor. Those all, each of those individual contracts, we contend really is one agreement governing the employee-employer relationship. And that's actually the same analysis that took place in Visual Fab, which I'll get to, but I
think to answer your question more. Was the confidentiality agreement at issue in the Larimore County, or was that just not really on the table?
The confidentiality agreement was at issue in Greenbelt. Yes, here's what this court said the issue is in the Weld County case with respect to the confidentiality agreement. The reason the court explains for its reversal and remand is because the factual dispute there is, was Mr. Kaczynski the kind of person who had access to confidential information? Because his defense that he's after the default, what he said is, here's what I would argue, that this stuff wasn't really, that I wasn't, as a CFO, I wasn't given the confidential information about how the meat was produced, how sales were happening on the meat side, all that kind of stuff. There are trade secrets at Colorado Premium, which is the name K2D uses. There are trade secrets, I just didn't have access to them. But he says exactly the opposite in the Larimer County case. And this is the answer to your question about how the confidentiality plays in. In Larimer, what the argument in Larimer is I was fraudulently induced because I didn't know all these facts about the company when I came to work for them. And I learned that during the term of my employment. And the things that I learned was that this company, K2D, allegedly was selling underweight packages of meat, allegedly wasn't following proper food safety handling practices. The underweight meat is paragraph 36 of the Larimer complaint. The food contamination risk is paragraph 35. So in Larimer, what he's arguing is, I did have access to all of this confidential information once I got to the company. And that caused me to realize I was fraudulently induced into coming here. In Weld, his defense to the confidentiality agreement is to say, I was just the business manager. I didn't have access to all this confidential information. And, you know, interestingly, in the Weld County case, if you look at his answer that's on file, or proposed answer, I think is a fair way to put it, that includes as an affirmative defense unclean hands. That's what he says in Weld County, unclean hands. I shouldn't be held to this confidentiality agreement. In Larimer, the whole point of his complaint is to list a set of grievances that he says, here are the things that are wrong with K2D. Now, we dispute those as a factual matter, and I trust I don't need to go into that because it wasn't litigated. But what his complaint is in Larimer is a litany of accusations of things that he says leave K2D with unclean hands. Again, we think those things are wrong, but the affirmative defense in Weld is exactly the substance of his claim in Larimer. And the Larimer complaint, at its heart, it doesn't really break out the causes of action as we've seen a typical complaint, but what we found, what they've now conceded, is that it's really a fraudulent inducement claim. When he says this, had I known all these things about K2D, I would have never gone to work for them. But fraudulent inducement is a defense to the breach of contract claim because he wouldn't have signed the confidentiality agreement but for his employment.
Counsel, let me ask you this, Mr. Williams. Is it possible for both parties to prevail on their claims without canceling out the other claims, the other side's claims? Could you prevail in your case, and could she prevail in her case?
If there's fraudulent inducement, if a jury would find in Larimer County that there was fraudulent inducement, we think that should be counterclaiming. Well, I don't see how K2D could prevail on a contract claim for breach of the confidentiality agreement. There may be other claims that are different, but in terms of those two core claims, I do think those would clearly cancel each other out. There were other claims in both cases, so that's why I'm pausing. But the nub of the case, the nub of Larimer, is fraudulent inducement, the nub of Well is breach of contract. And it's not true that the time frames are different. The misappropriation of trade secrets, the misappropriation of the information, just to put it literally in terms of what happened, Mr. Kaczynski was dismissed in the morning, and then the allegations are, and we think the evidence would show, that he essentially camped out in the parking lot that same day and then after the employees left, went in and took the information. So we would disagree that the Wells County claim didn't accrue for another year until he provided the information to a non-party here, a party that was adverse to K2D in a separate lawsuit that Boris is familiar with. The theft occurred as part of the circumstances of his dismissal, and that's what our state's case law says about this. This is a broad, flexible standard about whether there's a logical relationship. So I would respectfully disagree with the paradigm that we've heard from Mr. Kaczynski's counsel. The Allen versus Martin case probably is the leading case on the subject. And what that case was, we just look at the facts of these cases. You have an attorney who sued his former client for fees. Okay, that is a very straightforward contract claim, and we're all too familiar with those. You have the client who sued the attorney for professional negligence and breach of fiduciary duty. There are overlapping facts in those two cases, but this is not a case where you have a claim and a counterclaim on the same contract in any sense. You have professional negligence and breach of fiduciary duty are not our contract claims. Visual Factor versus Nutting, I think we all agree, is the only employment case in the state. And in that case, what you had is you had employee sues, I was a wage claim. So that's a contract claim. Employer says, I was defrauded into investing $80,000 into giving you supplies to produce book holders. Again, fraudulent induced, that's not claims back and forth on a contract. Those are just fundamentally different. And what Visual Factor goes on to explain is that it can still be compulsory counterclaims even though the evidence needed to establish the opposing claim may be quite different.
Well, wait a second. In your legal malpractice claim, Allen, I think you said.
Right.
The client's claim for malpractice would offset any damages that the lawyer is seeking for unpaid fees, correct?
That's true.
Right. In Weld County, was K2D, I want to call it K2, sorry, K2D seeking damages against Mr. Kaczynski?
No, they were thinking in terms
of... So what Mr. Kaczynski is seeking in terms of damages, there's not going to be an offset between those two.
No, I think that's right. But the law does not require a dollar offset. I mean, if a logical relationship is the test. And what Visual Factor does is it talks about different ways, and this is an older case, but it talks about different ways various courts have analyzed this, and says we're taking the much broader approach to respect really the policy reasons that I've talked about at the beginning of my argument about preventing multiplicity of proceedings, and I think preventing form shopping sort of falls into that rubric. I'd like to touch briefly, I know I'm running low on time, on the issue about whether the dismissal is under Rule 13 or Rule 12b-5. Let me just start by saying when the dismissal happened, everyone agreed it was under Rule 12b-5. So we filed a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-5. They filed a response, which is at the record at page 28. Page 6 of their response acknowledges it's a Rule 12b-5 motion. The judge, in his order, granted it pursuant to Rule 12b-5. Of course, he cited Rule 13, which we see a lot in Rule 12b dismissals, citations to other rule. We filed a motion for fees. They filed a response to our motion for fees, and their response didn't argue that it was Rule 13, not Rule 12b-5. Their response had a different theory that these were contract claims, even though they were clearly tort claims. It wasn't until oral argument on the fee issue, which was the first time they raised this Rule 13 premise. I think that would qualify as a waiver. But it's also just wrong on the merits. Rule 12b is the mechanism for dismissing claims under all sorts of rules of civil procedure. For example, insufficiency of service of process is Rule 12b-4. That's a failure to follow Rule 4. But you don't get a Rule 4 dismissal. You get a Rule 12b-4, you file your motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-4 for insufficient service of process under Rule 4. Failure to join an indispensable party is Rule 12b-6. That's a failure to join a party as required by Rule 19. But Rule 19 has no dismissal mechanism. Rule 12b-6 is the dismissal mechanism. Rule 12b-5, we see a lot of cases where what the defendant challenges in a Rule 12b-5 case is the adequacy of the pleading under Rule 8a or else under Rule 9b. And those are Rule 12b-5 dismissals. So this argument that came up for the first time, an oral argument, the judge in Larimer County got absolutely right. The mechanism for dismissing the cases is 12b-5.
Do you disagree with counsel? There's no reported case where a 13a dismissal resulted in attorney's fees awarded under the statute as a 12b dismissal?
I agree with her on that. I don't think that's dispositive when we look at the number of other cases like Crow versus Penrose, which is probably at this point the leading case, which is a Rule 12b-1 subject matter jurisdiction for failure to comply with Rule 106a-4. So it's the same principle. What we see in the Rule 13 cases is most of them actually do arise in the context of motion for summary judgment later in the case. That, when you actually look at the cases, that's what you see. But what we argue to the court below, and what I think is good law, is that if the trial court can make that assessment just based on the pleadings and is allowably looking at pleadings in other cases, that can be done pursuant to Rule 12b. So I agree, there's not a reported case yet that says that, but this is not an expansion of the law in any sense when you look at cases like Crow versus Penrose, which deals with failure to comply with Rule 106A4, or just all the other cases that look at Rule 12b dismissals for failure to comply with Rule 4 or Rule 19 or Rule 8 or Rule 9. I'll reserve
okay.
My last minute.
Okay. And counsel, it strikes me that the conversation today has been about your issues, the logical relationship test and the 13 versus 12b-5 mechanism. So it looks to me like you can hold the clock for the time being, Baylor. Sorry, I didn't mean to take the time. Why don't you give her another minute since I'm talking? I saw your face get concerned.
No, I was trying to poke your face. It didn't work.
So it looks to me like we did not go over to the other side's issues in any significant time. The remaining time that you have left, then, since you're not responding to issues that you didn't raise, then it should be about your two issues. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I'd like to take, I think, 30 seconds to respond to in rebuttal, and then I can take the remaining, I guess, 3.5 minutes to deal with the remaining issues. Is that, that's acceptable?
Yeah, let's do that. That's
okay, great. Wonderful. Justice Richmond, I'd like to respond more on point to, you had asked about efficiency, and if it involves the same witnesses, aren't the courts interested in that? When it comes to a compulsory counterclaim, I think the Bethune case is exemplary on that and explains what level it has to rise to. Because in Bethune, you had the same three parcels of land and literally the same parties at issue in the same two separate suits. And despite that overlap, the court said that because different contracts were at issue and neither would have the effect of canceling each other out, that efficiency was to be suborned to the more important thing, that it has to be a very significant common factual matrix. The second issue I'd like to address is, Justice Roman, your question with respect to canceling each other out. Plaintiffs' accounts have never said that they were fraudulently induced into signing a confidentiality agreement, and there is no finding on the confidentiality agreement whatsoever that would in any way cancel out fraudulent inducement to join K2D as an employer.
Ms. Clancy, could you address Mr. Williams' argument about the role of the confidentiality agreement overlapping as a sort of a defense in one and part of the other one?
Yes, and that's what I would like to address, is that literally there is no overlap. The confidentiality agreement, it did not come up at all in any of the Larimer pleadings. And remember, the court was looking at the pleadings. There was nothing alleged in the pleading with respect to the confidentiality agreement. And we have no defense to, the issue is there anything that we should have brought, that we brought in Larimer, that we would bring in Weld, and there's no overlap there. There simply is no relation as between the confidentiality agreement and his claims that he was fraudulently induced to join him as an employer.
Did you file an affirmative defense in a proposed answer saying he was fraudulently induced to enter the confidentiality agreement on which he was being sued in Weld County?
And that's a great point, Justice Richmond. No, he did not.
Okay.
He did not.
I thought I heard Mr. Williams say that, but okay. I haven't looked at the proposed answer, so...
No, the proposed answer, which was proposed after default was already mm-hmm. entered, mm-hmm. had nothing to do with that.
Okay.
And so there was no defense to the confidentiality agreement that he was violently induced into signing it. That was manufactured entirely by K2D.
Okay.
There's no set off one to the other, which is an excellent point, is a key criteria in a Rule 13A. Two remaining points. With respect to fees for collecting fees, their argument is that it's mandatory, that there's, quote, no authority in Colorado. They're asking this court, quite frankly, to overrule Foxley. Foxley says explicitly that if there is substantial justification for objecting to the fees, then under this precise statute, 1317.201, then that you do not get fees for your efforts in collecting fees. Anderson, which is the Colorado 2010 Supreme Court case, while it's dealing with 102, does continue to cite Foxley favorably as good law. So they're asking this court to overrule another division of this court. Second, with respect to the reasonableness of the rates and whether or not the judge abused his discretion in finding that they were not with the prevailing rates, their entire argument centers on, quote, no evidence. But the record shows, and we carefully set it forth in the briefing, that we stipulated to Exhibit G, which showed the prevailing rates in Denver. We brought it up at oral argument and said, this is the prevailing rates. Interestingly, in KTD's reply brief, there's a misquote, or half a quote. They say that we say, quote, you don't need to look at the prevailing rates. And then I go on to say, because they were already entered here as Exhibit G.
Counsel, your time is
up. Oh, thank you, Your Honor.
And Mr. Williams, a bailiff, give Mr. Williams an additional minute, please. And then I think we're balanced now.
This is reminding me of the World Cup. I think we're an extra time.
Judge Richman, let me just begin with, they did not raise an affirmative defense of fraudulent inducement in the Weld case. If they won on fraudulent inducement in Larimer or if they had that as a counterclaim, I think we all know they would be amending their affirmative defenses to add a fraudulent inducement. But I'd like to talk about is fees on fees quickly in 45 seconds. Foxley versus Foxley is not good law. Foxley versus Foxley, there were three bases for fees, Section 102, Section 201, and Rule 11. There is one sentence in there that says the Rule 102 standard should apply to Rule 201. That case was decided by this court in 1996. In two subsequent cases, this court has done the exact opposite. So this is not breaking new ground. In the Crow versus Penrose case, the whole appeal here, the entire appeal is on attorney's fees. And what Crow says at the end is you get attorney's fees under 201 for this appeal. You get fees for fees. And the Dubray versus Intertribal License Corp case, exact same pattern. The appeal was only over fees to this court. That's a 2008 opinion. Appeal was only over fees to this court, and this court says at the end of the opinion, you get fees under Rule 201 for bringing that. So this is not in any sense unprecedented. There's already a split among the panels of this court. And it makes sense, because the idea here is to make the defendant whole. And to say the defendant should get compensated for every step of the proceeding except what happens during the fee dispute defeats the purpose, because what would happen is that a plaintiff has every incentive to drag out and make those proceedings as difficult as possible to make it so that the defendant won't pursue his fees. There's no policy rationale for that, and I think it's inconsistent with more recent cases. In my last 10 seconds, there's one fact I'd like to point out on this issue about what the judge did on the rates. I would commend your attention Exhibit G, which is at the record. It's a supplemental exhibit. It's at page 169. What the judge in Fort Collins said is, in Denver, the location of defense counsel's firm, the median rate for partners practicing non-insurance litigation is $341 an hour, and then the associate rate. That was his finding. There was no testimony about that at the hearing, so there's no judging credibility. But if one looks at the actual report on which he relies, he literally just misread the chart. And since he did this himself, there's no reason you can't look at the exact same thing because there is no evidence going to how these charges should be read, but he's looking at page 176 in the supplemental exhibit, reading numbers that list rates for by city, but for all types of practices, literally all, not litigation, not any specific breakouts. The breakouts were actually on the prior page, and for various reasons, we don't think that's particularly compelling.
And counsel, your time is also expired, but we got it. Exhibit G, you said.
And can I just make, seriously, one sentence? The sample size here for the Denver numbers are tiny compared to the other numbers. This is not a representative sample, so there's no evidence to suggest otherwise at the year.
Thank you both for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.